Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. Today we open our show with the latest ramifications of the U.S. bombing of Iran, including attacks launched by Iran against a U.S. airbase in Qatar. Then on our Capitol Report, hear about what's been added into the budget bill, a provision that would sell off public lands, including vast tracts of Cleveland National Forest right here in San Diego's East County. We'll also have a special report on San Diego's new bishop taking a stand for immigrants at the downtown federal courthouse, successfully preventing ICE from picking up people for deportation, at least on World Refugee Day. Former Councilman Ben Colasso and his wife faced new arrest warrants after pulling a no-show in court. The Fallbrook Democratic Club hosted five candidates this week who are running for the 48th Congressional District, and we'll have some sound bites of what they had to say on our show today. If you live in the 1st Supervisorial District, you can now vote in that special election to replace Nora Vargas, who resigned. From California News Service, we'll have a special report on Pride Month. And we'll also have the latest update on the homeless count in El Cajon, which has been adjusted after findings at the point-in-time count included areas not in the city in its original estimate. Former Campo Community Planning Group Chair and longtime journalist Billie Jo Jannen has passed away, and we'll have a look back at her life and legacy on today's show. Plus, we'll tell you about some line item vetoes in the San Diego City budget implemented by Mayor Todd Gloria. Another inmate has died at the Las Colinas Jail, and we'll have a report on our show today. From California News Service, hear why California ranks 32nd in the nation for child well-being. Evacuation orders have been lifted in the Monte Fire in Lakeside, and the future of the Water Conservation Garden is at risk, with a big vote coming up this Thursday at the County Water Authority, which may end funding for the garden. And finally, we've ferreted out a human interest story for you on ferret legalization, which just cleared a major hurdle at the California Fish and Game Commission. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. Iran has fired multiple missiles at the largest U.S. airbase in the Middle East, in Qatar. The attack was launched in retaliation for the U.S. bombing of nuclear facilities in Iran. Qatar's air defenses intercepted the missile attack, and there have been no reports of injuries, CNN reports. Qatar condemns Iraq's attack on the airbase, calling it a flagrant violation of Qatar's sovereignty and airspace. After the bombing of the nuclear sites, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps said Iran will never leave any aggression against its territorial integrity, sovereignty, or national security unanswered. In the streets of Tehran, Iranians celebrated news of the missile strikes against the American military base, Reuters reports. The U.S. bombings of three nuclear sites in Iran were done in support of Israel over fears that could develop nuclear weapons. Israel struck first at Iran, and Iran retaliated by bombing Israel, with multiple further bombing exchanges by both sides. More than 400 people have been killed in Iran and another 3,000 injured, according to Iran, while Israel has said that Iranian missiles have killed 25 people in Israel and injured over 2,500 Israelis. Iran officially claims it is not developing nuclear weapons, and experts have said there is no evidence that Iran was close to attaining any. However, it has increased its uranium enrichment and uranium stockpiles to concerning levels. That began after President Donald Trump pulled out of the Iran Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty in 2018 that President Barack Obama had negotiated and initiated new sanctions on the regime. Tehran responded by halting compliance with parts of the agreement and started increasing uranium enrichment and uranium stockpiles and using advanced centrifuges, CNN reports. Iran also removed all equipment from the International Atomic Energy Agency that had been installed for surveillance and monitoring activities. The Biden administration was unsuccessful in its efforts to resurrect the nuclear pact with Iran. In 2023, the International Atomic Energy Agency said uranium particles enriched to over 83% purity, close to bomb-grade levels, were found at an Iranian nuclear facility. An IAEA report sent to member states last month said Iran's stock of 60% purity-enriched uranium had now grown to 408 kilograms. That is enough, if enriched further, for 9 nuclear weapons. Last year, the U.S. shortened Iran's time needed to produce enough fissile material for a nuclear weapon to just 1 or 2 weeks. Trump has said the U.S. dropped 30 bunker-busting bombs on Iran's largest nuclear site, Fordow, buried in a mountainside. Trump claimed Fordow is gone. But questions have been raised over the truthfulness of that claim. The BBC reports that Fox News host Sean Hannity posted fake videos claiming to show the bombed nuclear site in Iran, but in fact the video showed Israeli airstrikes in Syria back in December 2024. U.S. strikes on Iran likely inflicted very significant damage on 3 of its nuclear facilities, the head of the United Nations-led International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA, said Monday, The Hill reports. Speaking at an emergency gathering of the IAEA Board of Directors, Director General Rafael Grossi stressed the impact hasn't been independently assessed underground because of the ongoing conflict. There needs to be a cessation of hostilities for the necessary safety and security conditions to prevail so that Iran can let IAEA teams into the sites to assess the situation, he said. We continue to monitor the situation and encourage the Iranian regulator to maintain its contacts with the IAEA's Incident and Emergency Center. The U.S. bombing of Iran has raised several concerns. NBC reports that prior to the bombing, Iran sent a message to President Trump at the G7 summit that if he ordered strikes on Iran's nuclear facilities, Iran could activate sleeper cells in the U.S. to launch terror attacks. There are also fears of missile strikes against other U.S. air bases in the Middle East, where 10,000 American troops are within 15-minute striking distance of Iranian air attacks, and concerns have been raised over the potential to release radiation in Iran, though thus far that has not happened, according to the Iranian regime. Just days before the attack, Trump said he would give Iran up to 2 weeks to come to the negotiating table to seek a diplomatic solution. Instead, the president ordered stealth bombers carrying massive bunker buster bombs. Afterwards, he posted on his Truth Social site, "Congratulations to our great American warriors. There is not another military in the world that could have done this. Now is the time for peace." Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu praised America's actions in an address to his nation, indicating full operational coordination between Israeli defense forces and the U.S. military. He said of Iran's nuclear program, "This program threatened our very existence and also endangered the peace of the entire world." Netanyahu voiced gratitude, calling Trump a strong leader of the free world. Trump's ordering bombing of Iraq was done without congressional approval, which has drawn mixed reactions from lawmakers. Some praised the destruction of any potential nuclear weapons development by Iran, a state supporter of terrorism, while others voiced concerns over escalation of tensions in the region. And many congressional members have also denounced the action as unconstitutional, since it was done without approval of Congress, which the Constitution requires for acts of war. And clearly, dropping 32 bunker buster bombs on a foreign nation would constitute an act of war. The U.S. Constitution gives Congress the power to declare war and authorize military activity, not the president. But after Trump began threatening military action against Iran, lawmakers in both Senate and House of Representatives from both major parties put forward legislation that would have compelled Trump to go to Congress before attacking Iran's nuclear site. But the president ordered the bombings before Congress could vote on those bills. Congresswoman Sarah Jacobs, a Democrat from San Diego, posted on X, "Trump's strikes against Iran are not only unconstitutional, but an escalation that risks bringing the U.S. into another endless and deadly war." But San Diego Republican Congressman Daryl Issa, also posting on X, calls the action a night to salute the greatest and bravest military in the world, adding Operation Midnight Hammer, as the president calls it, will go down in history for its bravery and brilliance. Speaker Mike Johnson, a Republican, praised the action on X as well. "The president gave Iran's leaders every opportunity to make a deal, but Iran refused to commit to a nuclear disarmament agreement. President Trump has been consistent and clear that a nuclear-armed Iran will not be tolerated. That posture has now been enforced with strength, precision, and clarity," the speaker concluded. While most Republicans backed Trump's actions, some have voiced serious concerns. Representative Thomas Massey of Kentucky posted on X after learning of the bombings, "This is not constitutional." Massey helped lead a bipartisan war powers resolution that would have prohibited U.S. involvement in the Middle East dispute. Congressman Warren Davis of Ohio voiced similar qualms, The Hill reports. He stated, "While President Trump's decision may prove just, it's hard to conceive a rationale that is constitutional." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
This is John Tidwell with East County Magazine's Capitol Report. Senate Republicans have slipped language into the budget reconciliation bill that would allow the sale of millions of acres of federal public lands in 11 states, including California. The Wilderness Society calls this a disturbing giveaway that sets an extremely dangerous precedent. A map of lands to be sold includes much of Cleveland National Forest in San Diego's East County, as well as portions of Mount Laguna and Pine Valley, plus large tracts of U.S. Forest and Bureau of Land Management lands in Northeast County, desert areas near Anza-Borrego Desert State Park, and even some coastal locations. Over 16 million acres are proposed for sale in California, including Big Sur, an iconic and picturesque section of California's coastline. REI Coop says the bill would force the sale of up to 3.3 million acres of lands controlled by the Bureau of Land Management and the U.S. Forest Service. The National Forest Homeowners Association, which represents inholder owners of cabins in national forests, says the bill in the Senate proposes sale acreage that could include land under cabins in several states, as well as additional sales of federal lands in the future. The association calls the potential very troubling. Meyer Rathburn owns a cabin in East County within Cleveland National Forest on land that appears to be potentially put up for sale if the bill passes both houses of Congress and is signed by President Trump. She told East County Magazine, "We are in the process of renewing our permit near Pine Creek between Mount Laguna and Pine Valley." She says she only just heard about the language slipped into the Senate bill with no public notice. Cleveland National Forest was established in 1908 by President Theodore Roosevelt and named for President Grover Cleveland. "I thought it was irreversible," says Rathburn. "If you sell off these lands, you can't unsell them." Duncan McFetridge, co-founder of the Cleveland National Forest Foundation, says of the scheme, "It's just crazy. It's foolishness at the highest level." Even wilderness study areas, areas of critical environmental concern, roadless habitat, and critical wildlife habitat would all be eligible for sale to any interested party, according to the Wilderness Society, including vast tracts of the Arctic. According to the Center for American Progress, the bill provides zero opportunity for public input. An earlier effort to put a smaller amount of public lands up for sale was killed in the House after constituents flooded legislators with letters opposing a budget amendment there. Now, opponents of selling off America's public lands are hoping the public will again mobilize to defeat the Senate version of the bill. If passed by the Senate, the bill would then go back to the House to be approved and amended to the reconciliation budget bill. You can contact your representatives in the House and Senate to voice your views. You can also visit eastcountymagazine.org, where an article on the potential sale of public lands includes links to petitions from environmental organizations that concerned citizens like you can sign.
On World Refugee Day, June 21st, masked immigration agents were not leaning against the off-white walls at the federal courthouse in San Diego waiting to grab people. Instead, they scattered after seeing a clergy delegation led by Bishop-elect Michael Pham, Times of San Diego reports. Scott Reed of the immigrant aiding group San Diego Organizing Project, who observed the incident, says, like the story of Moses and Exodus, the Red Sea parted. The result? Nobody was detained, as immigration lawyers said would happen. Two cases were heard Friday morning by Judge Catherine Halliday Roberts, a man whose case was continued and a woman whose case had been administratively closed for 20 years and reopened by the government. Her case was also continued. Jesuit priest Scott Santarosa, pastor of Our Lady of Guadalupe Parish in San Diego, briefed camera crews and other media members who weren't allowed into the courtroom. "Our presence made a difference," he said. An activist present said that recently, 2 to 4 immigrants a day have been detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, and taken away in vans operated by private prison Corps Civic, all part of President Donald Trump's crackdown on undocumented immigrants, arresting even those who show up for immigration hearings at the courthouse before a judge can grant them legal status. On June 21st, at least two white vans were parked on an adjacent street with no license plates but padlocks on side doors, Times of San Diego reports. Bishop Pham, a Vietnamese refugee who came to the U.S. as a child, said ICE agents were standing there covered with masks as we walked toward the courtroom. Eventually, he said, the agents scattered and went away. And, he added, no wonder people come in fear. Pham continued the mission of his predecessor, Cardinal Robert McElroy, also an outspoken advocate for immigrants, before leaving to be Archbishop of Washington, D.C. Pham said a government lawyer struck up a chat in the restroom and said he feels conflicted with the situation, he knows his morals and his values. Father Santa Rosa said masked ICE agents were an intimidating presence despite the fact that the federal court staff was very accommodating. Immigrants, he said, came with great fear and trepidation. Father Manny Del Rio of St. John the Cross in Lemon Grove stated, it was evident that our presence made a difference. This was one of the last peaceful times in a long time with no immigrants being detained. Besides 10 clergy members and the press, at least a dozen activists assembled outside the building and handed out sheets in English and Spanish titled, Know Your Rights, ICE Arrests at Immigration Courthouses. Under What to Do If Arrested was this advice. If you fear returning to your home country, say it clearly and out loud to the ICE officers and request a credible fear interview. Another sheet gave information about the group Detention Resistance with hotline numbers to call, email addresses, and social media pages. One woman brought a wagon with snacks. Bishop Pham, who celebrated Mass at St. Joseph Cathedral before hopping on a bus to the federal building, suggested that priests will return for similar walks in solidarity at immigration court. Or a ministry could be started in the San Diego Imperial County's diocese to replicate Friday's event. Pham said Santa Rosa would be the one to spearhead such a ministry. All things are possible with God, Santa Rosa told Times of San Diego. This is a need that arises. I think we could conceivably come up with a schedule where some priests could be court witnesses and accompany immigrants. He said he was told that ICE agents had intended to detain some immigrants Friday, and their lawyers expressed gratitude to the assembled clergy. After the hearings, Bishop Pham and other clergy, including Imam Taha Hassan of the Islamic Center of San Diego, formed a circle with activist observers in the first floor lobby. Pham called immigration one of the important issues today. He said he prayed for wisdom and insight to help our poor brothers through the crises in their lives. A formal prayer was led by Auxiliary Bishop Ramon Bejarano, who was born in Texas but spent his early life in Mexico when his family moved back there soon after his birth. Bejarano said, "Bless these refugees and asylum seekers and all those who seek opportunity." Since the end of May, an activist with the group Detention Resistance said he's been a witness to detainee arrests at the San Diego courthouse. Anyone who's arrived in the last 2 years who does not have a child that is their dependent or doesn't have a serious medical condition can be detained, said the man, who declined to be named. And things have gotten even worse with Trump as president. Sometimes we've seen them see someone's file, oh, look, they have a cancer diagnosis, and let them go. But now, he said, there are many people in Otay Mesa, the detention facility right now, who have cancer and aren't being released. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. KNSJ Radio is dedicated to providing nonprofit news in the public interest, not special interests. We rely on your support to continue bringing you important stories from San Diego and East County that you won't hear anywhere else. Please make a generous donation at knsj.org to sustain KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
The Fallbrook Democratic Club, on June 22nd, hosted all five Democratic candidates who have declared to run against Congressman Darrell Issa in the 48th Congressional District. Moments before candidates took the stage, news broke that the United States had bombed nuclear facilities in Iran. Dr. Suzanne Till, a Marine Corps veteran, was quick to denounce Trump's action as unconstitutional.
I'm also a Marine Corps vet. I served in the Gulf War. And you got the news tonight. You all know, when we had the Gulf War and the war in Iraq, we had a debate in Congress. This was public. What he has done is completely out of line. He may think it's legal, but there should have been a debate in Congress about this. This should have been a public debate, and it didn't. And this is why it's so important we need more Democratic congressmen and women to bring back the balance of power.
Whitney Shanahan, a pro-choice activist, chose to speak about Trump's criminalization of abortion, including her own personal experience.
2019, I found myself pregnant and in a red state. I went to the ER having pregnancy complications, and instead of being helped, I was separated from my partner and I was questioned about what I had done to cause it. Because at that time, Ohio was working to pass a 6-week heartbeat abortion ban. 6 weeks is before most people even know they are pregnant. And a 6-week ban not just criminalizes abortion, it also criminalizes miscarriage. I went home that day from the ER shaken and scared. I looked up online and I did some research, and I found that there were hundreds of women in the United States who have been arrested, detained, and investigated. And this was while Roe v. Wade was in place, and that was simply for their pregnancies. In that moment, my life changed forever. I called a few of my friends who also happened to be pregnant, and we went to the state house and we wrote in red lipstick on our stomachs, pro-choice. The photos and the videos from that first protest went incredibly viral. And since then, I have held hundreds of protests nationwide to defend human rights and our access to bodily autonomy and abortion.
Curtis Morrison, an immigration attorney, chose to speak about immigration issues.
Trump did a whole bunch of other bans during COVID that people didn't realize because they were focused on COVID. And actually, he probably did the most comprehensive ban of immigration in his last year. I represented several thousand plaintiffs and got injunctive relief that caused a lot of people to be able to immigrate from 2020 to like 2023. And I'm very proud of that. So what... You would think during the Biden administration, I would get this big break. No. He did not undo, rescind, unwind most of the most harmful immigration policies. And so I spent the last 4 years suing Biden for things that Trump put in place. In one case, Biden appealed one of our victories against Trump, and we had to take it to the appeals court because Biden's like carrying Trump's water on immigration. It's crazy. So now, Trump's back, and guess what? I'm still challenging travel bans.
Albert Mora, a retired investment banker, sought to deliver a message of hope amid troubling times.
I love science. 13.8 billion years ago, right, the Big Bang happened, we think, and then there is this trillions of galaxies with hundreds of billions of stars, but we're riding inside the Milky Way galaxy on a planet that is rotating, spinning around this beautiful sun with a moon around it. And what a gift it is to be here, period. Not just because I had my heart attack, all right? To be born and raised in the United States of America, talk about lucky, right? This is a challenge right now to be here, right? We're all talking about the war that apparently is starting right now. But what have humans been doing from the beginning of time? I'm going to go back to my history background and my science, my love for science. We've been through so much. We have been through wars. We discovered fire. We discovered relativity. We got through 2 world wars. We got through the Cold War. There are more than 8 billion human beings alive today. You know why? We're great. And I am our biggest fan. I believe in us. We will make it through this.
Brian Nash, a datalytics expert, spoke on the need for campaign finance reform.
If no one is willing to actually put in the work to make something different happen, and that has to start at the very bottom, from the school boards, from the city councils, to the water boards, to this role, the presidency, everything else. People have to say no to the status quo and want to do something different. And so when I talk about the idea that we need to do campaign finance reform, everyone says, but why? For me, it's simple. It comes down to, if people can just go into Congress and make millions upon millions of dollars for themselves, Democrat or Republican, based on stock trades, why are they going to waste their time helping us? Why not just spend more time focusing on how they can further line their pockets?
Reporting for KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Former El Cajon City Council member Besman Ben Colasho and his wife Jessica Dede Colasho failed to show in court on June 9th to begin serving 8-day jail sentences for contempt of court in a civil defamation case. The judge issued new arrest warrants for the couple, who were slated to appear in Superior Court here on a separate matter on July 2nd in a lawsuit filed by the City of El Cajon over code compliance issues at a Fletcher Hills home that they own. The Colossus, who say they are now living in North Carolina, could be arrested if they show up for that hearing or anywhere else in California. The San Diego Superior Court Judge Wendy Bayan issued a pair of $25,000 bench warrants for the Colossus, who were initially ordered 2 years ago to serve jail sentences, but still haven't done so. In August 2023, Judge Kenneth Medill found both Ben and Jessica Colosio guilty on 4 counts each of contempt of court in a civil defamation case won by attorney Lena Chari. The Colosios were ordered to report to San Diego Superior Court in September to begin serving an 8-day jail sentence, as well as pay fines of $1,000 apiece for each count, but never showed up. The two were granted a stay to appear in court for an April 23rd code enforcement hearing in the city's case alleging unpermitted major construction at their El Cajon home. In May, Judge Joel Wolfville found in that case that the Colossus made unpermitted construction changes using unlicensed contractors, but also ruled against the City of El Cajon's request to impose over $2.5 million in fines, but left open the possibility of imposing future fines. The city testified at the April hearings that Colosio created the alias of Avon Ayers to avoid paying the code enforcement fines, and Judge Wolfield ruled that Von Ayers is indeed an alias of Ben Colosio. The Colossus are set to be back in court on July 2nd for a status conference in the code enforcement case, including setting an inspection date for the Colossus home, a briefing scheduled to resolve undetermined issues, and more. They will likely appear remotely to avoid arrest. Lena Chari's civil defamation case against the Colossus was filed back in 2017, a year after Colossio was elected to the El Cajon City Council. Colossio later resigned in disgrace after settling a case alleging sexual misconduct and defamation of several other people, including beauty contestants in a pageant run by a nonprofit operated by the Colossus and later shut down by the state. Although the case originally was part of a broader defamation case with several other defendants who settled their cases, Chari refused to settle and ultimately won her case. Colosio was found by the court to have falsely claimed Chari had sex in public places in retaliation after she sued him over a vehicle in a car wash he owned crashed into her property next door. Chari voices frustration at the lack of accountability. She notes that in televised high-profile trial for serious crimes, as soon as someone is convicted, they get cuffed and taken to jail right then and there from the courtroom. They don't get to go home and come back at a later date. But because the Colossus crimes did not stem from dangerous acts, the courtroom gave them some leeway to get their affairs in order and for them to turn themselves into jail voluntarily. Now, after the Colossus repeatedly defied court orders, the new bench warrants mean that if arrested, they can pay $25,000 bail, which lets them free on the promise that they will appear in court and lose that money if they don't show up again. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Marie Johnson.
You're listening to the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for San Diego's inland region. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
San Diego Mayor Todd Gloria has wielded his line item
veto
power to deny funding for numerous projects. The mayor's action cut public access at some city lakes and reservoirs, including many in East County. The Lakes Murray and Miramar will remain accessible daily, which the mayor acknowledges is due to hearing from San Diegans who wanted these to remain open daily. Lakes facing cutbacks in hours or days of operation include Lake Hodges, Barrett Reservoir, El Capitan, San Vicente Reservoir, Sutherland Reservoir, and Otay Lakes. Those cuts will save the city about $208,000 in the coming fiscal year. The mayor also vetoed funding for numerous other items, from homeless outreach to brush clearing and stormwater projects to prevent fires and flood. He also preserved funding for other popular items previously on the chopping block, such as libraries and fire pits for beach bonfires. The city of San Diego is currently looking at a budget deficit of $258 million in the coming fiscal year, which starts July 1. The shortfall is related to declining revenue from property taxes, transient occupancy tax, and sales tax, lower than projected San Diego gas and electric franchise fees, and increased expenses, including costs of employee pensions. Gloria's line item veto has been met with frustration from lake-loving community members. El Cajon resident Rob McGarkle caused a gut punch while at Lake Otay, where 60 boats were on the water, he adds. Our hope is the council is still on our side and overrides this line item veto. Friends of San Diego Lake say in a statement, the line item veto of specific, highly used, revenue-generating lakes was a striking blow to the city's professed priorities of equity and recreational access. The group calls on the City Council to restore the proposed full access at all city-owned lakes. The budget does restore hours at 16 city libraries that were slated to be cut, as well as restore recreation center hours, as well as access to restrooms at beaches and Balboa Park. Beach fire pits will be preserved thanks to the county offering funding to assure that beach bonfires can go on. While Gloria said he is committed to investing in critical stormwater, including clearing 18 miles of stormwater in the coming year, a contingency funding request for nearly $760,000 more was vetoed. The veto of some stormwater clearance funding comes despite severe flooding last January that led to massive property destruction and lawsuits against the city. The press release says Gloria believes the contingency funding, quote, lacked an identified need at this time and would not result in any new construction of stormwater projects, unquote. Gloria vetoed other additional expenditures proposed by the City Council, including $900,000 from the Council's discretionary funds for community projects, programs, and services, $450,000 from the Council's arts, culture, and community festivals, a $225,000 chief operating officer position, and $450,000 to management positions in the city's Office of Race and Equity. Shane Harris, president of the People's Association of Justice Advocates, is calling for the council to override the mayor's line item veto on several things, including community projects, programs, and services. Harris says, quote, many of those funds impact residents directly and nonprofits who assist them, especially during a time where it is unclear how much support these same organizations will get from Washington, D.C. or Sacramento, unquote. He adds, quote, we must ensure council offices have the resources for their respective districts, unquote. Another $250,000 in funding for homeless outreach was also slashed by the mayor's line item veto. Mayor Gloria also vetoed $1.1 million in brush management enforcement. Harris says San Diego should be protective on fire preparedness, especially considering what happened with the Los Angeles fires in January and the heat wave expected to hit San Diego this summer. In all, the City Council's changes added $19.2 million in general fund expenditures to the mayor's final proposed budget. Gloria's line item veto shrinks these additions by nearly $5 million. Gloria said of the line item vetoes, quote, as mayor, I cannot in good conscience allow a budget built on shaky assumptions to move forward, not when we're facing national economic uncertainty, global instability, and real threats to the federal and state funding we rely on, unquote. The 9-member San Diego Council now has until June 26th to accept or override Gloria's package of vetoes. An override would require a 2/3 supermajority or 6 votes. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Marie Johnson.
A special election is now underway to fill the vacancy left on the County Board of Supervisors when Nora Vargas resigned. The two candidates are Imperial Beach Mayor Paloma Aguirre, a Democrat, and Chula Vista Mayor John McCann, a Republican. If you live in the county of San Diego's 1st Supervisorial District, you can cast your ballot early at any one of 7 vote centers in the district. Some vote center locations have changed since the primary election in April, so be sure to check the list of locations before you head out to cast your ballot. The vote centers are open daily from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. now through June 30th. On the final day of voting, July 1st, 6 more vote centers will open. The voting centers now open are at the Bonita Vista Middle School Cafeteria, Chula Vista City Hall, the MAAC Community Center, South Bay Union School District Auditorium, Mountain View Community Center's back meeting room, San Ysidro Senior Center, and the Spring Valley Community Center. You can find a vote center or an official ballot drop-off box near you inside your voter information pamphlet, or look up your pamphlet online with the View Voter Information Pamphlet tool at sdvote.com. Vote centers have replaced polling places and provide more services. You can vote in person or drop off a mail-in ballot. Vote using an accessible ballot marking device. Receive assistance in voting materials in multiple languages, or register to vote or update your voter registration and vote on the same day. District 1 runs from the Pacific Ocean to the Otay and San Miguel Mountains in the east, and from Barrio Logan in the north to the U.S.-Mexico international border on the south. The district includes the cities of Chula Vista, Imperial Beach, National City, some communities in the city of San Diego, including Barrio Logan, East Village, Golden Hill, and more, and the unincorporated areas of Bonita, East Otay Mesa, Lincoln Acres, Sunnyside, La Presa, and parts of Spring Valley. If you're not sure if you live in District 1, you can look it up at sdvote.com. For East County Magazine, on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
June is Pride Month, and transgender advocates are speaking out, seeking equal recognition in society and in the workplace. The U.S. Supreme Court recently ruled that President Donald Trump can enforce a ban on transgender people in the military while litigation proceeds. Martha Gomez with the nonprofit TransCanWork says the attacks on transgender people ultimately hurt society as a whole.
Of course, transgender are at the forefront of a lot of those attacks, but the truth is that these DEI cuts, they hurt all of us as a nation to not have opinions outside of just one.
The armed forces are also changing the names of transgender members of the military back to their names at birth. TransCanWork encourages all employers to consider the harm of deadnaming people and to make sure healthcare policy and legal paperwork is inclusive. They offer job training and reentry services in order to fight higher employment rates among transgender groups, which range from 9% to 16%, much higher than the national rate of 4.2%. Gomez would like employers to make sure employee compensation is fair and based entirely on a job well done without regard to gender identity.
Compared to a white cis man, gay or lesbian women tend to make about 89 cents of that dollar. Transgender people make about 69 cents and Black transgender women only make 43 cents of that dollar.
Transgender, gender diverse, and intersex individuals continue to face high rates of economic insecurity, job discrimination, and barriers to stable employment. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The Regional Task Force on Homelessness has acknowledged that its 2025 point-in-time count overstated the number of homeless people in the city of El Cajon. The report included 24 homeless individuals who were outside city limits. Originally, the report listed 344 unsheltered people in El Cajon, more than a 21% rise over the prior year. In fact, the increase was around 13%, for a total of 320 unsheltered persons living on the streets in El Cajon. The city also has 695 people living in shelters. The task force says that in the future, to reflect this geographic area more accurately, the census tract designation will change from El Cajon to El Cajon, including unincorporated communities. The change follows criticisms from City Manager Graham Mitchell and Mayor Bill Wells over the findings of the count done in January. Mitchell, who participated in the count, says it included two census tracts that were completely outside of the city limits, as well as five more that were at least partially outside. The city suggests that its still substantial number of homeless has been driven in part by the county placing homeless individuals in El Cajon motels as part of a voucher program, a situation that some other cities don't face. The county recently closed its safe parking area for the homeless just outside El Cajon city limits for remodeling, which may be further exacerbating homelessness in neighboring El Cajon. Mayor Wells has criticized the count methodology, but told City News Service that he appreciated the task force working with El Cajon to clarify the numbers. The regional task force's CEO acknowledges the point-in-time count is an imperfect tool, but says it's a vital one in helping understand the scope of homelessness in our region. The 2025 point-in-time count of homeless people conducted in January found large drops in homelessness countywide in almost every community, with a 72% drop in families living on the streets, indicators that efforts to help the homeless are likely having positive results. Countywide, the point-in-time count's 1,700 volunteers found 9,905 homeless people, a decrease from 10,605 in January the year before. The 2025 count included about 5,700 unsheltered San Diegans and 4,200 individuals in shelters and transitional housing. In East County, only El Cajon showed an increase. The City of El Cajon supports several programs to help the homeless, including substantial funding for the East County Transitional Living Center, which shelters many people, and families transitioning off the streets, as well as tiny homes and other programs offering services for unhoused individuals. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
Billie Jo Jannen, an award-winning journalist and chair of the Campo Lake Morena Community Planning Group for the past 12 years, died May 27th of cancer at age 69. Jannen was a powerful voice for backcountry residents. She won awards for investigative reporting and spent nearly 25 years as a reporter and editor covering East County's hottest topics such as wildfires, wind turbines, as well as border and land use issues. Her coverage drew national attention on national TV shows, including 60 Minutes and 2020. She also rooted out tales of feral pigs and turkey hunts, offered tips on how to remove horse manure, and covered local politics. As Jannen Riley noted, some might see similarities in these topics. Her ascendancy into a stellar journalism career didn't take the usual career path. After losing a finger in a printing press, she moved from Oregon to California to pursue an engineering degree, but never finished due to marrying and having her first child. She began writing feature stories for the Alpine Sun, then moved to Campo, where she discovered her true calling, investigative reporting. Her first expose was on illegal dumping of transformers by the county in Campo. She later started the Eastern Empire Guardian, an online news site dealing strictly with backcountry news in East County. Later offered a job as managing editor of the Alpine Sun, she also freelanced for other news outlets, including the San Diego Union-Tribune, North County Times, the Daily Californian, and East County Magazine. Jannen also hosted the TGIF Report, a radio show on backcountry issues that aired on My 107.9 radio in Alpine. She also created the first website for the county's task force on fire protection and emergency medical services. Her journalism awards include first place honors from California Newspaper Publishers Association for her work in environment, education, and border coverage, as well as recognition from San Diego County Board of Supervisors and California State Assembly. She also won awards from San Diego Press Club and the Sierra Club. Her reporting of the battles surrounding the proposed Campo landfill won broad recognition, leading to a book on the subject. Her breaking stories also resulted in reforms in county, state, and federal policies. Her community service includes serving as a member of the Comprehensive Economic Development Strategy Committee and the Rural Economic Action League, a backcountry economic development think tank. Donna Tisdale, a longtime chair of the Boulevard Community Planning Group, says of Jannen, Through her years as a reporter, Billie Jo played a huge role in keeping the backcountry and beyond informed on most, if not all, the battles we fought to defend that ruggedly beautiful area from so many obnoxious projects. She also reported on the border and smuggling issues that plagued us for decades, along with many other issues, Tisdale recalls. Tisdale, a close friend of Janin's for more than 40 years, calls her a kind and intelligent person who will be deeply missed. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Tidwell.
A woman who died at the Las Colinas Detention and Reentry Facility in Santee on June 13th has been identified as Linda Bagby. She was 53 years old and from El Cajon. This is the sixth in-custody death this year at detention facilities in San Diego County. Deputies were serving dinner when they found Bagby unresponsive in her cell, according to Lieutenant Juan Marquez. Upon observing the situation, the deputies immediately activated 911, requested assistance from the facility's medical staff, and began CPR. Paramedics in the Santee Fire Department assumed life-saving measures upon their arrival, he says, but despite those efforts, Bagby was pronounced deceased at the detention facility around 4:30. Bagby had been in custody since January 3rd and was facing multiple charges, including assault with a deadly weapon, false imprisonment, and felony vandalism. A press release from the Sheriff's Department states, "The San Diego Sheriff's Office extends our sympathies to the Bagby family and all those affected by Ms. Bagby's passing. A Sheriff's Family Liaison Officer will continue to support the family as they navigate through this difficult time." The Citizens Law Enforcement Review Board was notified about the incident. As is protocol for all in-custody deaths, the Sheriff's Homicide Unit responded and is conducting an investigation to ensure all aspects of the incident are examined. The cause and manner of the death will be determined by the medical examiner's office. The San Diego Sheriff's Office has been under fire for years because San Diego County has the highest number of in-custody deaths of any major county in San Diego. And while Sheriff Kelly Martinez has implemented some reforms, the latest death reveals that there is still more work to be done. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
California ranks 32nd in the nation for overall child well-being, according to the new 2025 Kids Count report from the Annie E. Casey Foundation. When you consider the percentage of kids covered by health insurance, the Golden State does well, at 3rd in the nation. But the state drops to 30th for education outcomes. Kelly Hardy with Children Now says 3/4 of 8th graders are not proficient in math, and slightly more than 70% of 4th graders are not proficient in reading.
We rank 49th in number of teachers per students in the classroom. A lot of it comes down to just amount of spending on education. It may seem like we're spending a lot, but we rank just 43rd in the percent of our GDP spent on our schools.
A big increase in education spending is unlikely because California faces a $12 billion budget deficit and the state is bracing for large cuts in federal funding, especially to Medi-Cal. Hardy notes that the data show the housing crisis has not improved. 41% of people in California have to spend more than 30% of their income just to put a roof over their heads.
California is the absolute worst state in the nation in terms of percent of income spent on housing. That means that parents have to choose from putting food on the table and paying for rent, and it really puts families in a bind.
Leslie Bossier with the Annie E. Casey Foundation says the data shows stubborn racial disparities for children of color.
For example, the child well-being outcomes on 15 out of 16 indicators for Native kids are lower than the national average. If you look at Black kids, it's 8 out of 16 indicators where outcomes are lower than the national average.
For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
All evacuation orders and warnings have been lifted in the Monte Fire, which burned over 1,000 acres in Lakeside's El Monte Valley over several days. Firefighters battled rugged terrain and other perils, including rattlesnakes and the dense vegetation. 3 firefighters were treated at local hospitals for minor injuries, including smoke inhalation. The fast-moving wildfire caused several road closures and forced some residents to evacuate for days. Cause of the Monte Fire remains under investigation. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. KNSJ Radio is dedicated to providing nonprofit news in the public interest, not special interests. We rely on your support to continue bringing you important stories from San Diego and East County that you won't hear anywhere else. Please make a generous donation at knsj.org to sustain KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
On June 26th, Thursday, San Diego County Water Authority, or the CWA, will vote on a staff recommendation to end its sponsorship and funding of the Water Conservation Garden. The garden says accessibility to the public is at risk if the CWA withdraws. Its director has started an online petition called Save the Water Conservation Garden at change.org. As of our show taping deadline, the petition has received over 1,500 signatures in less than 48 hours. The public is encouraged to testify at the CWA hearings, including a finance committee hearing at 9 a.m. and the full board meeting at 2 p.m. Staff propose just two options, to withdraw or to withdraw and donate $150,000 over the next 2 years. The petition asks for a third option to be considered, have the CWA stay in the Water Conservation Authority and continue full funding. The garden is operated by the Water Conservation Authority, six public entities, with their contract up for renewal at the end of June. The City of San Diego withdrew last month due to the city's own budget crisis, and with 40% of a weighted vote on the CWA, the city may pull CWA out as well. This would mean a loss of one-third of the garden's total funding. Funding the garden would be a fraction of 1% of CWA's total proposed budget. The remaining members of the Water Conservation Authority have committed to continuing support, but without the CWA, may be forced to turn over control of the garden to the Grossmont-Cuyamaca Community College District, which owns the land. Lynn Nault, chancellor of the college district, has said her mandate is education, and she wants to preserve some public access, but if the garden converts to a college facility, public access could be sharply limited. Brian Olney, Helix Water District General Manager and current acting administrator of the garden, says the garden is the only venue of its kind in the county and offers an incredible ability to educate the region on our very complex and reliable water systems. The garden has consistently earned more and spent less than budgeted since the Water Conservation Authority took over the management of the garden from the now defunct Friends of the Garden in April 2024. With all new management practices and updates to the facility, it came back stronger than ever, even gaining accreditation as an arboretum. The garden operates on a lean budget, with a modestly paid staff of 3 full-time and 2 part-time employees made possible because of enthusiastic volunteers. Since July, 100 volunteers on 25 work teams donated over 10,000 hours, a testament to the community's engagement and dedication to the garden's mission. For 25 years now, the garden has served as a 6-acre public model of sustainable practices. It provides information and educational programs for all ages, as well as serving as a dog-friendly and family-friendly venue and an oasis for the community. It offers classes on sustainable best practices, as well as wellness and yoga in the garden. Over the years, around 90,000 elementary and middle school students have visited on school and scouting field trips. The garden provides information and displays on both water-wise and fire-wise landscaping, both critical in an era of drought conditions and high fire danger. Plus, the garden hosts events such as Tomato Mania, plant sales, and the Spring Garden and Butterfly Festival, drawing crowds of thousands. Lauren Magnuson, Director of Garden Operations, says the Water Conservation Garden is more than a collection of drought-tolerant plants. It's a living classroom, a sanctuary, and a community asset. With the support of public agencies like our water districts, we give back to ratepayers in immeasurable ways through education, inspiration, and sustainable solutions that ripple far beyond the garden gates, she concludes. Magnuson encourages the public to sign the Save the Water Conservation Garden petition at change.org and send an email to CWA members before Thursday's vote that could determine whether or not the Water Conservation Garden will survive as a treasured public resource. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Ferrets may be moving a step closer to being allowed to thrive in homes as pets in California. Ferret legalization advocate Pat Wright, a La Mesa resident and leader of the nonprofit LegalizeFerrets.org, reports that the California Fish and Game Commission has unanimously approved his petition for a regulation change to remove ferrets from the restricted species list. While generally prohibited, permits for possessing ferrets may be issued for research, public exhibits, or educational purposes, but not for personal pet ownership. The matter now goes to the California Department of Fish and Wildlife for analysis and a recommendation on the future of the ferret as a domesticated animal, after which Fish and Game will issue a final decision. Wright has long asserted that the agency's decision to categorize domestic ferrets as wild animals without conducting scientific studies or affording meaningful public input is unjust and lacks a foundation in scientific evidence. California has continued to ban domestic ferrets because state officials claim the animals pose a risk to wildlife, public health, and the environment. But ferrets are legal in 48 other states, many with climates and ecosystems very similar to California's. The only other state to ban them is Hawaii. A key concern is that if ferrets escape, they could survive in the wild and form feral breeding populations potentially harmful to native wildlife. Other concerns are potential biting incidents and rabies transmission. Wright says he expects research will show that no state has experienced those problems. Just tens of thousands of happy, healthy pet ferrets and responsible owners. He says it's time for California to update its policies to reflect facts, not fear. As part of a 50-state survey Wright is undertaking, he says the group is seeking to weasel out which regulations each state has in place where ferrets are legal. These include requiring rabies vaccinations of pet ferrets, registration, spaying or neutering, and bans on sale in pet stores. At the state Fish and Game meeting on June 11th in Sacramento, Wright called in to make the case for legalization, as did San Diego resident Kim Eppend. Eppend said, "Ferrets are not wild animals, they are not dangerous, and they have never formed a feral colony in North America. It's not right to keep these animals illegal in California." Speaking against the case for domestic ferrets to be removed from the state's list of prohibited species, the California Waterfowl Association Vice President of Advocacy Mark Hennelly brought up a case of ferrets being predators of waterfowl, pheasants, rabbits, and other animals, and said ferrets have wreaked havoc in New Zealand. Wright counters that while ferrets are problematic in New Zealand, the type of ferrets in that country are wild European polecats and ferret hybrids who were intentionally introduced in the late 1880s to control the rabbit population there. Wright also notes that New Zealand is an island ecosystem with no native mammals as predators. He testified that in more than 40 years of legal ownership in those states in the U.S. where they are legal, ferrets have never formed a feral population or wiped out native wildlife. Wright said, using New Zealand as an argument against responsible pet ownership in California is like banning goldfish because of a carp invasion in Asia, a tactic he called intellectually lazy and intentionally misleading. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, dedicated to ferreting out fascinating stories, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, AK Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. KNSJ Radio is dedicated to providing nonprofit news in the public interest, not special interests. We rely on your support to continue bringing you important stories from San Diego and East County that you won't hear anywhere else. Please make a generous donation at knsj.org to sustain KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.